Welcome back to PS Voice, where PS contributors speak with the newspapers that publish them. In this episode, former editor-in-chief of The Economist, Bill Emmett, speaks with Niels Tygesen, an eminent economist who chairs the European Fiscal Board, about EU monetary integration and the future of the Eurozone. In this first section, we evaluate the Eurozone's past.
So, Niels, critics of the euro area, of which there are many, have characterized it as being one of deep division between debtors and creditors, even a debtor's prison on the one side from the debtor's point of view and the creditors feeling that it's a place where the debtors steal their money. Looking at 2016, which is what your report has studied and made recommendations about, how do you think this division has evolved? Are we still with that extreme divide?
The divide is clearly less extreme than it was at the depths of the crisis in 2011-13, when everybody was consolidating their public finances, weak and strong countries. Since then, we've had steady growth, modest but still sustained now for four years at least. And during that period, of course, tensions have eased somewhat. Now all countries except one or two have surpluses on current account, on external account. They have greatly reduced their public deficits from about 6% to 1.5%, I think, for the euro area as a whole by now. And that clearly shows up in 2016 also, that there was a reasonably good economic performance. And that obviously eases the tension. But it is still there because of the legacy of the crisis and the very different levels of debt and difficulties that that debt has left the countries with.
One of the legacies of that crisis and of the cutting that your report very interestingly highlights is that while there has been a lot of reduction of deficits and even some countries of debt, much of the reduction in public expenditure has been found in public investment. And indeed, you point out that public investment in the euro area is at its lowest level since 1995. From a layman's point of view, at least, that sounds like the opposite of what Europe needs.
It is indeed the opposite of what Europe needs. And it's also the natural political reaction when you have a crisis. It is easier to postpone public investment expenditures than to cut back or restrain in some way public consumption, notably public salaries, pensions. But clearly investments are important, both because they generate demand, and they generate demand more effectively, in fact, than increasing pensions or even public consumption. And they also generate supply capacity for the future, which is essential to Europe's growth. So the fact that public investment is, as you say, lower as a ratio of total GDP than it has been for 20 years is a source of concern.
An important thing that your report mentioned is that Germany, for example, didn't use its fiscal space. How should we do? How should we change the rule to make it possible, knowing that very often the governments are reluctant to use this fiscal space?
Fiscal space is a very interesting concept. It's difficult to measure exactly what it is. The Germans will say we have more or less full employment. On the other hand, the German economy has a very large external surplus, and it has public finances that have performed better than they had undertaken to perform. But the problem with the European rules, if you regard it as a problem, it certainly is that these aims for the public finances, they are targets for those that perform worse than the targets, but they're not targets in the sense that if you perform better, you have some space that you can use. But we see, after all, in the German debate, as in the Dutch debate now, this year, when both of these countries have had elections, that this issue is coming to the fore, and there will no doubt be some correction of the investment shortfall, which is particularly notable in the German case.
Key question for the future and for the potential growth. We know that if, for example, Germany don't invest enough in its infrastructure, it could be a problem for its growth. How could we put a bit more pressure on this country and the other ones to be sure that they invest enough in their own infrastructure?
I mean, we have a so-called excessive deficit procedure. Shouldn't there be an excessive surplus procedure?
For example,
that is always a problem in international agreements. It's been at the global level. There was not much pressure on countries in surplus at the global level, the United States originally, Germany, Japan at times. In Europe, there's the same problem that rules apply to countries that are not behaving as well as they should. They're not constraining those that perform better from going even further into surpluses on the fiscal side and on the balance of payment side. But we do suggest a somewhat more symmetrical system in the future, where also fiscal space is used more regularly than has been the case so far.
One of the strange things about the Eurozone from a layman's point of view is that you've got two targets, deficits and debt, and overall levels of public debt. Which do you think it's actually better to target? I mean, most economics textbooks tell you you should focus on one target and not several.
That is true. Debt is, in a way, the logical target if your main aim is to preserve long-term budget sustainability, soundness of public finances. But debt is a long-term concept, and measures of sustainability of public finances are also subject to considerable uncertainty. So the argument for also looking at the deficit is, of course, that the deficit is a way of controlling the evolution of debt. Initially, one had chose to have both because there was a lot of off-balance accounting also among governments. The Germans, for example, had their unification costs going into debt without going through the deficit. So it was useful to look at both at the same time, but to certainly rely on both. But you are right that it would, in a way, be logical to focus more exclusively on debt.
From a creditor's point of view, and you look at Italy at 132-point-something% of GDP, their public debt, and of course Greece at 178, nearly 180%, how on earth can those be called sustainable levels? They seem extraordinarily high still.
They have become almost sustainable in this extraordinary period we've had of monetary accommodation and interest rates on public debt that are near zero. The borrowing costs are so low. In the evolution over the past few years of public finances, this factor has played an important role, that the cost of servicing the debt has gone down fast. So the Italians and the Greeks also will say, well, we're not paying more than we used to pay in terms of servicing the debt. It may still be sustainable, but I think that this is certainly a short-term view, because we are not guaranteed that these interest rates will last, and they will not last. They will rise slowly, but so we have time to correct it. But clearly, figures well in excess of 100 are very suspect in a long-term perspective.
And now, the Eurozone's future.
Marie, coming from France and from Le Monde, what would you like to ask Professor Tigerson about President Macron's proposals for reforming the Eurozone?
Yes, Mr. Macron thinks we should go toward a more federal Eurozone with a common finance minister, a common budget. Do you think it's a good idea that we should go there? Are the states ready for this idea?
I think President Macron has a better chance of succeeding in this effort than any of his predecessors. But there are still important differences of opinion as to what should a European finance minister in fact do, what kind of authority should he have. In the German view, still a German European minister of finance would mainly have the authority to, in a sense, arbitrate and override national budgetary decisions that went beyond a basically rules-based system, whereas the French view is on the collective policy joint initiative, joint stabilization function. I think, in fact, we need some elements of both. We need still some reliance on the rules, but we need also, and that is the lesson from the crisis, that in extraordinary times, we do need to be able to take some action at the European level before the crisis breaks out.
So over to you on the central fiscal capacity. What would you like to ask?
It's an interesting idea. How could it work, and how could we be sure that it improves the world functioning of the Eurozone, and how could we finance it? How could we finance it also?
I mean, and just adding to that, I mean, a central fiscal capacity. I mean, how would we recognize that it exists in the Eurozone? I mean, how will it work? Mm. But also, this is an EU budget able to spend and borrow.
There are various ways in which one can finance something like a central fiscal capacity. One way is through borrowing, in fact, joint borrowing and then investing in projects in different countries. There's already a touch of that in the so-called Juncker plan of public investment, encouraging public investment and ideas that go in the direction of protecting public investment against the kind of fall during difficult periods that we discussed before. Is indeed one such way of building up a central capacity. And that may be, in the shorter term, the easiest way, because it doesn't raise complicated issues of transfers between countries. So I think not only Jacques Delors, but even people who preceded him proposed it is a joint unemployment reinsurance fund, where you top up somehow employment performance that is particularly bad during a recession in countries relative to their normal levels of employment, but it creates considerable measurement problems also to judge when is the appropriate time to do such an effort. But that is clearly one that could help to stabilize. There's also the idea of having, of course, the most ambitious idea in a way of increasing the European Euro area budget or the European Union budget as a whole, as President Juncker has suggested in his latest State of the Union speech, where you then have funds for, in a sense, more on a more discretionary basis at the European level, deciding where to advance public expenditure in different countries.
And do you support that proposal of President
Juncker? We give it, in a sense, at the moment, the benefit of the doubt. We say the most realistic in the short term is probably this investment protection scheme. Mm. The others seem to require a bit more work on calculating the possible effects, how it would work, but it could be done.
So right now, even as we talk, the parties in Germany are sitting down negotiating a new coalition between the Christian Democrats and CSU and the Greens and the Free Democrats. This topic of an EU budget, of a Eurozone finance minister, of central fiscal capacity, how will that figure in their discussions, do you think?
I have no inside information on that, but it's no doubt going to be a very difficult discussion for the Germans. Some more difficult than others, but I think particularly the idea of enlarging the European budget may be difficult.
Now the European framework, all these procedures are very complicated for common people, very hard to understand, even for us sometimes. How could we make this whole framework more transparent, more democratic for people?
I think the lack of trust, in a way, in this whole machinery of the rules-based system is in part due to the conflict between countries that have been in a stronger and a weaker position. And I hope that as growth continues, apparently now for another couple of years at least, this tension will fade a bit away and there will be more consensus on a simplified system of rules which should still be preserved. They are useful. We cannot do without them, but they have become so very complicated. And the lack of trust between countries has meant that there's so much involvement of national officials in overseeing this whole system that it is becoming too complex simply to be transparent and understandable, certainly for the outside world.
But one of the risks is that when there is growth and things are going better, there are less pressures to make reforms. It's one of the problems in Europe. When everything is okay, we are less working on improving the fiscal union, the banking union, for example. So you are still optimistic about that?
I think the Commission and the government seem to have the priority that the first issue to deal with now in the next couple of years will be completing the banking union, which also is potentially a major risk for government finances, of course, if we have another crisis in a few years' time. So I think that will be a test in the very short term. But in the meantime, there will be some evolution in the discussion of the fiscal rules and the idea of streamlining both the rules and the decision-making process maybe along the lines that President Macron has suggested.
Now, you made in your report, I thought, what seemed to me to be quite a kind of tough or draconian proposal, that one way of enforcing these fiscal rules, maybe even in a more transparent way, would be to make the use of EU funds, even existing EU funds, let alone an expanded budget, conditional. Or how do you think that would go? That would be received in Italy, say, or in Greece, or Portugal?
It's a fact, of course, so far that that there are sanctions in principle available to the Commission, can propose them, and it's very difficult to vote them down if they are in fact proposed. They have never been proposed. That is clearly because in a difficult situation, it's not easy to apply a sanction which worsens the public finances of the countries concerned. So there is the alternative mechanism of using other EU funds, structural funds, that already also exists in a consultation process with the European Parliament in that case. And there is a third possibility, since not all countries receive these structural funds in large measure, to look more generally at the European budget, which could include also agricultural support policies, for example. That would give a much wider basis for pressure. It would not go down well, obviously, in countries that were affected or seen as being affected by such a widening of the sanctions mechanism. But if you want to have some effective sanctions, that is the direction you could go. We just mentioned it as a possibility. If you want to have that possibility of sanctions, that may be how you have to go.
Would that go down well in France?
No.
Never is in France. Sanctions, it's complicated, because often the governments, not only in France, are used to mention Brussels as a place where all the problems are coming from. So how could we make it work better also on a political point of view between the governments and Brussels to have better relationships?
That is in a way a paradox that has been with us since the start of economic and monetary union, because most governments, particularly most finance ministers, will recognize when they are alone, or at least amongst themselves, that some external pressure, some external agreement on what is solid behavior that can assure fiscal sustainability is a constructive step. And that was why these rules were adopted in the first place, also by France and Italy. They welcomed that. But when you are in a crisis and when you have a high level of debt, of course, the mindset changes a bit, and you are under stronger pressure at home for not observing these rules.
Do you think, I mean, one thing that could change the image, as Marie implies, of Brussels being the problem rather than the solution, could be a really effective move on public investment, identifying then Brussels with the revival of public investment? How would the protection scheme that you talk about do that? Is the Juncker plan what's needed? How effective is it?
I think the Juncker plan is a step certainly in the right direction, and quite a considerable scheme now. It's mobilized also a lot of private resources, so it should be one that is also appealing to public opinion at home, and expanding it, going into other areas could be even more helpful. That is also the appeal, obviously, behind the unemployment insurance fund, that this is something that would make it more appealing to the electorates at home and the national policy-making function, that something is coming also from Brussels. But something is coming already, of course. Many countries are having very substantial inputs from Brussels into their investment programs, into structural funds.
When we talk about the future of the Eurozone, what are the other big challenge, according to you? Is it all these reforms? Is it the monetary policy, which we will have to become more more tough? Is it the problems maybe possible coming with Brexit and all this negotiation going on? What are the main challenge?
I think the challenge, which is also underlying the discussion we've had on fiscal policy, is that we cannot rely in the longer term on the kind of monetary policy we've had for the last 5 years or so, since the European Central Bank made its, in a sense, declaration that it was prepared to support national bond markets if countries were also prepared to accept conditional programs. Since then, of course, sustainability issues have faded a bit away. We cannot expect that these conditions can continue. They may continue for another couple of years, according to the ECB itself. But we must rebalance somewhat the policy mix between fiscal and monetary policy, and do a little bit more, be a little bit more generous on the fiscal side, and a little bit less generous on the monetary side. And that will happen over the next 2 or 3 years, I'm sure.
Now, one thing that's been, to some viewers, strange about this discussion is that we've had one person from a euro member country and two from people who are not in the euro. Now, we know the answer about Britain, but what's the answer about Denmark? Are you going to join the euro anytime soon?
I frankly don't think so, although I think it would be a good idea, because we are, in contrast to Britain, a country that follows policies in the euro area more closely than many countries in the euro area. We have sound public finances. We have even some external surplus, considerable external surplus. We have interest rates that are fully aligned to those of the ECB, even slightly lower at times. So the case for joining is not so strong. I mean, we have the benefits, and we don't have the risks of participating maybe in expensive actions to rescue governments or banks in other parts of Europe. So from a cynical point of view, it is understandable, I think, why we're not joining, but it's still regrettable because we're not part of the deliberations in the Union.
Yep, something that the British will learn about being outside the table where things of that influence their own economies are decided.
Indeed.
So we've run out of time, but it's been an excellent discussion. I want to thank Marie Chirel from Le Monde and Niels Tigerson from University of Copenhagen, but above all from the EU Fiscal Board, for being with us today. Thank you very much.